Welcome to the Avery Hill podcast. My name is Lizzie Stewart. Normally I'm an illustrator and author, published sometimes by Avery Hill, but this month I've taken the reins as presenter to talk to artist, author and bad lad of the Petanque Pistes, Owen D. Pommery. Owen is the author of three books with Avery Hill, Between the Billboards, Victory Point and now The Hard Switch, which is publishing this month. He also wrote British Ice, published by Top Shelf, and works as a freelance illustrator, creating images for clients as rich and varied as The New Yorker, Apple, The Economist, and Airbnb. He is also, and I say this in the name of full disclosure, my partner. Welcome, Owen, to a room in our flat where we are pretending to have a podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. So let's kick it off by having a read of the blurb of the book, and then maybe you could sort of pad it out a bit and tell us a bit more about the story of The Hard Switch.
Absolutely. So, The Hard Switch is coming. The time approaches when the mineral that makes inter-system jump navigation possible will run out. When the last piece has gone, the vast and scattered inhabitants of the galaxy will be stuck wherever they are. Some will have the means to choose this. Others will take what they've got, or at least the best they can get. Either way, society as it has been for aeons will exist in a new state. In the face of this impending seismic change, the crew of a small cargo freighter struggle to make a living amid the chaos and desperation. Survival would be enough, but a chance discovery alters their plans and may prove to be a vital key to unlocking a future for all, not just the chosen few. So that's what it says on the back, and yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. It's the story of a small crew who are sort of navigating a sort of vast galaxy and come up against various obstacles that are only getting worse in the face of this calamity.
And who makes up this crew?
It's a crew of three. It's the pilot, Hiker. It's the engineer, Malik, who's a kind of cephalopod, kind of octopus-type character, and Ada, who is an extractor, which is the title of someone who hunts down this dwindling mineral from old shipwrecks and utilises it for either finance or for their own propulsion.
Right, thank you. I'm saying right. I've read the book, and I think it's very good. In fact, I've been up close to this process for, I would guess, almost as long as you, in that I read a very, very early draft. And so the process of putting it together is pretty familiar to me, but for those listening who don't live in this house, the first version of Hard Switch was a Word document, just a script. Can you talk a bit about the writing process? Are you a planner? Do you just feel things out? I mean, I know the answers, but I'm encouraging you to share it.
It's not like a strict process, and I don't really think about it, but it has always been the same for every project I've undertaken. And it always kind of starts with a kind of visual start point, and I see it as almost like a placeholder. I'll draw quite a well-rendered single image. In the case of this one, there's a page which features one of the characters sat at a kiosk at night in this kind of edge of the galaxy sort of spaceport. And I was kind of intrigued by the image I'd created and why I'd created it and who that character would be and why she would be there. And all my projects seem to start in that way, of kind of creating a sort of miniature snapshot within a world. And then I start answering those questions that I just outlined there, and that takes the form of essentially an outline where I'm sort of writing scenes as sentences or paragraphs. And when I've got enough of those that fit together to make what I think of as a kind of like a physical structural arch, so it has all these kind of keystones that kind of lock into place. When you put the final one in, it can actually take weight and is a complete thing. And at that point, I'm ready to go and start writing a script, and I write it very much like a script. I guess it's got a bit lighter on the terms of the expositional stuff, because that just has to remind me, oh, they do this, they go there, and then I just write lines as to what they're going to be saying. And then it's a back and forth process, so when I've got that finalized, I run it past people and get notes and change things. And even when I'm at the point of like, okay, now it's time to draw it up, as you sort of uncover things through the drawing process, I can then go back and alter the script a little to fit that. And obviously the mechanics of comics and speech bubbles and all the rest of it come into it as well. So it's a back and forth process at that point. And I'll sometimes jump around, sometimes I'll do it out of sequence, but it can be quite linear as well. So yeah, that's kind of how it goes.
And when you've done the script, you make rough drawings, which I think most graphic novelists do. I make very sloppy roughs, but they're minor, sort of designed like the pages of a book. They're sort of at scale. But I've clocked what you do. I've seen it. They're tiny, your thumbnails, and they are, I would say, decipherable maybe only by you. However, they are somehow completely functional as roughs to you, which suggests that the world exists quite clearly in visual form in your head, that you can read these really tiny, very loose sketches as something that will become a very, very complex, detailed image. Is it very vivid after, once you've written it, do you feel like you can traverse that world quite confidently, even with just a tiny thumbnail sketch to guide you?
Yeah, so I kind of know the vague locations that are going to be in each one. So when I kind of go, when I bring it to like a new location, when I'm doing the thumbnail of that, I'm like, oh, we need an establishing shot of it. That's not to say I don't get tripped up. Like, there's sort of mechanics that come in. Like, oh, we need more of that space, or we need less of that, or there's actually more dialogue to get across, so we need to spend more time here. And if there's dialogue, does it need sort of dead space behind it or more rich detail? So that stuff gets tailored. My thumbnails are very small and very rough, and I'm literally trying to work out how many speech bubbles I can fit on there and how much information is going to be conveyed per page. And then when it gets up to full size, I'm sort of starting from quite a rough page and I work it all the way through,
yeah,
with pencil to ink. Within that process, a lot of working out happens at that point. The thumbnail is almost just like a little placeholder, like that's a page probably. Yeah. And then the actual working out, the sort of thrashing out, comes as part of the drawing. Like, I'll even be inking up bits when there's other bits that haven't been fully resolved.
Yeah, I have seen this happen and actually not really registered, because it goes quite rapidly from rough to inked image. So I suppose at the start, yeah, of the day, maybe I see the pencil sketches, then I leave, I go to the studio, and by the time I get home, it's an inked up page, and maybe I don't see the workings so much.
Yeah, and also that my roughs are the final one. Like, a lot of people will rough and then trace it,
yeah,
or whatever. So when I've rubbed away the pencil, it's just the ink left. There's sort of no record of that process at all. It's literally the thumbnail and the inked line. Like, so it's almost like that didn't happen, but a lot of stuff happened in there. All the stuff happened in that bit.
And this is not a major question. I'm just curious, actually, because I don't think I've ever asked you. When does you have a very specific colour palette in actually each of your books. When does that happen? When do you plan that palette? Is that there from the start? Or is it when you colour the first page, do you just go, these are the colours then? Or is there a plan in your head from the start? The colours in this book are delicious. They're so bright and jewel-toned. They're really good. And I wonder when did they come to you?
Yeah, it's from the beginning, I suppose. And they're sort of deliberately restricted. Like, there's a set amount,
yeah,
and there's very few unique colours in the book. Like, the yellow is the yellow, you know, wherever it sort of turns up. And there are sort of tweaks and exceptions, and then obviously sometimes it'll work better than others, but, like, to have an infinite palette would sort of be insane to me. Like it sort of needs to be visually cohesive. So I have a digital palette of colours that remains consistent.
Yeah.
And then there's exceptions that break it, but essentially that's the red, that's the you know, and so they're all predefined. So when I get to like a different location or a different sort of set of characters or whatever, it's the same red that comes back in, and that anchors the whole thing.
Yeah, but you do a thing where like there's a different lead colour in each location, almost like this place skews more yellow, this place is
that's true bluer. Yeah.
Yeah, which gives, I suppose, gives the illusion of a vast, rich palette without making it so densely packed with colour that it's like difficult to look at and difficult to read as a reader, in fact. So relatively early on in the drawing process, I remember you saying that you hadn't really banked on how exhausting it was to have to invent every single aspect of the world your characters inhabit. I would say that the draw of an O&D Pomeroy project is, for many people, the vivid world building, and the fact that you draw places that people want to just step straight into. Victory Point is a prime example of that. I don't think there's a reader of that book who wouldn't happily take a quick vacation in Victory Point. This kind of beautiful modernist seaside town, for those who haven't read it. The hard switch is just as immersive. Do you want to talk a bit about how you create spaces and environments? Because it's such a, they're such a key player in your books.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a result of my architectural background that I'm sort of fascinated by spaces and locations and making those believable. And it certainly hasn't been the sole drive of what I've tried to do with my other books, but it has become a key sort of component of them and why people have connected with them. And for everyone that I've done, I've had people contact me or say that they've Googled the locations to see if they are real. And they're all very different, but, and it was never my intention to sort of deceive or sort of trick people into thinking these places existed, but I wanted them to feel so real that I kind of went overboard and overshot it. And it was interesting, having had that as a background in my last few books, to think, well, where would people definitely not think it was real, but could I use the same trick into making it feel like it could be real? So yeah, the next sort of step felt like science fiction, where I can I make you feel at home in space? Let's find out. Yeah, that was kind of the impetus for that.
And I think you do that with the ship in particular by including very mundane details that explain what life is like for these characters living aboard this ship. I think, for me, a personal favourite of the kind of invented world, the coffee pot that they use, it's very appealing. It sort of references, obviously, the Bialetti that we use every day in our kitchen, that kind of way of making coffee, but it's like Bialetti, but in space. And so it rings true in a very appealing way. Also, there's a lot of kiosks, which are a recurring motif in your work, I would say, if we can be as pretentious as to use the word motif. What are your favourite fake things in The Hard Switch, I suppose?
Well, that's, you're right. I mean, that's your kind of way into it. It's about putting things that are domestically recognisable or just changed a little bit enough that they are odd but familiar. And yeah, I think sort of kiosks are a fun way of doing that, particularly. I sort of think it's a very unique form of architecture where it only has one role to fill at the kiosk. So it can be sort of a bit mad. As long as you can, I don't know, sell tickets out of it, it can be any shape you want. And you see sort of novelty ones promoting things, or it's a very sort of human scale of architecture. So even if it's selling something you can't conceive because it's a science fiction or fantasy thing, like, you know what it's like to step up to a kiosk, and the way it's lit and the way it's sort of is hyper commercial, or maybe it's kind of subtle, or or things like that. And the same, you're right, with the kind of domestic elements of the ship. It's they're little things we all do and sort of know how they work, and it doesn't matter if it's on a spaceship or if it's on a boat or if it's in a house or caravan. Like, they are sort of unique things. We know what it's like to have coffee in the morning. And that anchors you and carries you through this world.
There's a kiosk that looks a bit like an axolotl. Lizardy. Are they a lizard? They're a lizard. Amphibian?
I think it's a salamander.
Okay, cool. And just then when you said about the materials that make the kiosk, I was like, oh yeah, I can imagine walking up to the axolotl type lizard kiosk thing and it being made of fiberglass and seeing that fiberglass texture on the inside.
Yeah.
Because I remember that, because it's a bit like a leisure centre kiosk, a kind of novelty structure. It's very pleasing, and I like whenever I spot it in the background of the world. The story centres, as we've mentioned, on Ada and Hiker and Malik. To me, it's as much about the push-pull of a long-term friendship and how people balance one another out as it is a story about kind of space travel and aliens and so forth. How do your characters come to you? Is that a thing that you're thinking about? Are they referencing existing people, or are they sort of dictated to you by the plot? I think we probably have a different approach to this, and I don't know if I know what yours is.
Yeah, I don't think I sort of have thought too much about it. I think my previous works have kind of centred on an individual, and you kind of follow them through it. Particularly my first book, Between the Billboards, it's like very singular, Victory Point's very singular. And even British Eyes, which is a bit more of an ensemble, it's definitely viewed through the sort of central character's eyes and his journey. So this was much more of an ensemble. There isn't a main protagonist. So the characters were sort of designed as a balancing act, to create a sort of triangle of sort of tension and synchronicity sort of between them. So they kind of wanted to feel, I liked the fact there was three of them, so they could ally in certain ways. Like, two of them would sort of back each other up in one area, or the other two would relate in another. So there was always a kind of like third vote for any sort of situation that came up. I liked the idea of the dynamic where they're sort of constantly having to make decisions and are sort of cross-referencing each other. And so it was kind of that, really, I think, that which led to the different character types. They're definitely like an amalgam of like different people that I know, or aspects of people that I know. And I'm like, oh, those aspects work together to make this new character. And yeah, and the more that starts to form, they start to write themselves, so you sort of know what the counter argument to one of their points will be and who will say it. Like, if Ada makes a point, then depending on what that point is, I know that, oh, Malik's going to question that on a sort of logical basis, or Hiker's going to question that on an emotional basis. It starts to sort of write itself, which is nice, because then they start to feel more three-dimensional.
And where does drawing them fit into that? Do you feel like you have to draw them before you can write any of them, or is it back and forth?
It's a bit like, as I said earlier, with the kind of writing of the whole thing, there's kind of like an initial image that I do of them. And when I get them right, even if it's only in a one-off, I'm like, oh, that's them. Mm. That's them there. And I'm always trying to get back to that first version almost, even though I know them better by the end of the book.
Yeah.
And you know, everyone's hypercritical of their own work, but there's like, there's so many panels in the book, and there'll be so many times when each character features, and I sort of know when I've got the closest to each one of them, I can sort of point to the exact panel, like, oh, that's the most Ada I could have drawn, and that's the most Hiker I could have drawn. Malik's an octopus, so he's pretty much the same throughout. And no one's noticed any subtle differences anyway. But
it's deeply unfair the way that your own drawing sort of migrates away from the thing it's meant to be as you keep drawing it. I'm sure many people get better at drawing a thing as they draw a person over and over again. It refines and becomes better, but I do feel like we have both discussed the ways in which there is, like a prototype that is good, and then you're just always trying to get back to the most perfect, clearest iteration of this character, and it sometimes your hand sort of betrays you and won't make the face that you want it to. It's not on. The book takes place over a relatively short span of time, which we understand exists within a much bigger crisis. There are parallels with this planet's environmental collapse, capitalist overlords, as well as the perilous and tragic lengths refugees are forced to take to save their own lives. But I think you're always very careful to avoid moralising. It's not preachy, I don't think. But it does, as a story, retain sort of unambiguous anger about the state of this fictional galaxy and also our own. I think the same can be said about your earlier book, British Ice. So I wonder, what role does our reality play in your fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's very obvious when you look at it, but it feels very subtle when I'm working on it. Like, how can you not sort of be reacting to all the things that are happening around you, and how can that not show up in your work? I don't think I've ever been a sort of fantasist in that my work doesn't exist separate to the things I'm thinking and feeling or trying to process, and just trying to feel out a different way of talking about them, really. So yeah, the real world comes into it a lot.
Good. Good is my response to that. And if the real world plays a role, I think I'm going to guess that fiction plays a role as an influence as well. I know that you're fond, for example, of a B-movie and generally that cinema is a pretty major influence on what you're doing. So I wonder if you could explain where all this nonsense comes from.
It comes from a whole series of different nonsenses, and I think B movies is a really good example. They're kind of used as a kind of shorthand for like lesser entertainment or like not as mainstream, but it's the limitations of that form that make it interesting to me, and that could be the economic limitations. Like, you don't have much budget and you have to try and create a world, and where do you point the camera to kind of convince the audience in the shortest amount of time or with the most limited amount of resources that there's a whole world that exists kind of outside the frame. Or it could be sort of conceptual limitations, I have a soft spot for The Hunt for October, which is like a submarine drama, and it's how do you make that exciting, because there's nothing visually to see. It's just lots of similar looking men in dark rooms looking at looking at computers, and you're supposed to believe they're sort of chasing each other around the kind of ocean floor and trying to second guess their moves and so forth. So that's a real limitation. If your action doesn't have any visibility, like, how do you create the action? So that's sort of fascinating to me. Or it can be more sort of whimsical or silly. I watched Tremors the other day for the first time in ages and was sort of reminded how sort of delightfully sort of ridiculous that concept is, where you just have like half a dozen characters and a couple of buildings and vehicles in the desert. And then how do you use those things to outwit some, spoilers, sandworms? And, it's an hour and a half, but it's like there isn't a wasted minute in that movie. And they're working very hard to make it as economic and sort of perfect as possible. And there's a really nice sort of we've got away with it kind of feeling of those kind of films. And sort of like I watch, I'm like a big fan of the film Prospect, which is like a low budget science fiction from the last couple of years. And again, you're sort of stuck with like a couple of characters in a location, but the things they talk about and the things they reference and the few bits of equipment and sort of ephemera that you see within the frame sort of hint at this world that's outside of it. And that was like a really big touchstone for the hard switch, because we're following like a small group of sort of tangible people in a very, very realized space, but it's small, and we're getting these glimpses out at these kind of vistas of a larger sort of galaxy and all the problems that it has. But there's obviously a limit to how much you can show, so it's kind of like pulling back each time, because if you try to cover it all, it would kind of be an insanity project. And I'm trying to sort of like just follow their point of view through it.
Yeah, I think I was about to say it's interesting what you say about limitation, as if I have not heard how you feel about the power of limitation before. But it's true that I think it applies very neatly to graphic novels and comics, because there is the physical limitation of having to draw it, and so you can't throw everything at a story. Because your body will give up before you've got even a quarter of a way through the story. And I think that maybe there's a tendency to, in the first iteration of a graphic novel idea, is to think like you can just keep adding more and more because it's in your imagination. If you can draw it, it can be in the story. But there's a real I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. There's like a richness that comes with paring it back to essential details and just hinting at the rest of the world out there. And I think you do that really well.
Well, I think there's almost like a self-editing process that comes in with graphic novels because of the length of time it takes to draw things. Like this same problem exists in writing, in the, like, oh, because I've thought of all this backstory and all this world building, I better put it on the page. And then the sort of often with sort of people's, certainly their sort of first novels and things, it's about stripping all that stuff out. Like, you need to know that as the writer, but the audience doesn't need to know that. They need to know these one or two bits of information. They don't need all this wealth of stuff. Now, the same process happens in graphic novels, but because you're faced with the prospect of drawing, or like, oh my God, I've got to draw all that, and then you stop and go, do I have to? And if there's a way I don't, no, actually I don't. It almost makes you make that decision quicker than writing sort of like several pages of establishing prose or something.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like people who read but do not create graphic novels would be shocked to discover how often their favourite authors are trying to not draw things, like desperately trying not to have to draw something. You mentioned novels briefly there, and I know that you're a reader, because I see you reading things around the flat. I catch you with your head in a book quite frequently. Were there books that fed into this project, things that you were thinking about whilst you were working on the book?
In terms of like fiction, nothing specific, but I'm a big fan of, as we've talked about, limitations, economy. So I like books that convey the most amount of things to me in the shortest amount of time, because it feels like a kind of magic trick. Like, you told me these three words and I imagined 10 more. So that was kind of a good start point in terms of like the kind of fiction that I wanted to create. I like that I reference things in the hard switch that you hopefully pick up what they are from context, but they don't get explained to you, and it's then feels more natural how people refer to them in the world. I actually get most of my kind of inspiration, if that isn't too grandiose, from sort of non-fiction really, and most of my ideas come from a very sort of real situation or historical situation or something that happens elsewhere, and I kind of take it in a certain direction, or what if that went in this direction or took this turn, or if that was the start point but it wasn't there, it was like, there's kind of infinite jumping off points available in nonfiction, and those are probably my richest minds, I suppose, for going forward. I suppose you could say that The Hard Switch is sort of semi-influenced by, I still do read quite a lot of travel books and exploration. As a kid, I read like the Kon-Tiki expedition. I was kind of fascinated by that concept of this kind of little controlled world adrift in an ocean of sort of vast unknowing potentials, death and terror. So there's definitely a bit of that in The Hard Switch, where you have this kind of like very small little sort of domestic cabin barreling through this kind of vast galaxy, things like that. And there's a kind of, I guess, fairly well-worn path. That's not a pun, but in the kind of travel world of like the journey being a narrative, and these things keep turning up along the way, and you have this set of characters kind of reacting to them, growing from them, learning from them, or being affronted by them. So there's definitely a bit of that in The Hard Switch, I would say.
Interesting. I don't think people would have put a sci-fi graphic novel and Diary of the Kon-Tiki Expedition next to each other on a bookshelf. But I think that actually speaks to the fact that although this book maybe outwardly appears like a sci-fi story, there's a lot of other stuff going on. And if you enjoyed Victory Point, I think there's things in this book that are for you, even though it seems outwardly like a complete pivot. And I think that's, you've got annoyingly, frustratingly, a galling amount of stories in your head, and they kind of bounce around from world to world. You've written about a nihilistic loner in Between the Billboards, horrifying colonial legacies in British Ice, and then the emotional subtleties of returning to your hometown in Victory Point. They seem like drastically different stories, but there's definitely stuff that links them. Do you see them as being very, very different books, or is this just, does this seem like a very logical set of stories for the Owen D. Pomeroy oeuvre? Sorry.
I'm interested in a number of different things, so I like that I get to explore them, explore different kind of contexts and characters. But if there was a kind of common thread, it's characters or people sort of having a reckoning with something, and it's generally triggered by their environment. They're all quite environmental books, so it's like a change of place, which then sort of makes them confront something about either the world or themselves, and trying to come to terms with that, I suppose. And that's probably as autobiographical as they get as well. Like, I'm always trying to sort of interrogate my thinking on any given issue or circumstance that turns up, and that can be sort of quite quiet and domestic in the case of like Victory Point, or it can be, how do I cope with everything collapsing and changing, which is The Hard Switch, and sort of everything in between. It's me trying to work something out, I suppose, through these characters and how they react to the things that are presented to them.
Lovely answer.
Thank you.
Lovely stuff. Okay, to wrap up, I'm going to do some quick-ish fire questions.
All right.
Sit tight, brace yourself. These are going to be tough. Hiker, Ada, Malik, who are you calling on to go for a drink with?
I think it would have to be Hiker. I think she's the most kind of easygoing, and I think I'd enjoy going for a drink with all of them in different ways, but I think Ica would be the most fun.
The octopus?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, we're probably quite similar, me and the octopus, to be honest.
Yeah, maybe. You've got to live in one of your locations. Are you choosing a spooky manor house in an Arctic territory? A picturesque modernist utopia by the sea, or the ship from the Hard Switch?
That's tricky. For a weekend away, I would definitely choose the modernist seaside town. But as that book is essentially about why you might not want to accept that as your future, I think I would. I mean, if the world wasn't so horrible, I'd probably take the ship in the Hard Switch, because then you can essentially go anywhere and you have your own little world with you, which I think is something I'm slightly obsessed with anyway. I like camping, for example.
You do like camping. And to take a moment to describe the room we are currently in, we're in Owen's studio / the spare room. Everything is very neatly stored away. There's wine boxes building a kind of movable modular bookshelf system, which also extends to the desk system. It's very very kind of compartmenty. Is that the word? So it's not a stretch to transfer the way you live now to a ship of some kind.
Yeah, that's true.
What did you listen to whilst working on the Hard Switch? I know you make playlists for your books.
I do make playlists for my books. This one was the hardest one to do that for, because I think because of the mixture of characters involved, like I couldn't imagine what music they would play in the ship, which they'd all be happy listening to. So it was quite hard to sort of settle on a sort of tonal tracks. I listened to soundtracks and things. I listened to the soundtrack of Prospect, which is the film I mentioned earlier, which is kind of quite atmospheric for that kind of thing. But I guess there was music I listened to that was quite sort of, that informed its attitude, I suppose, which doesn't necessarily mean its tone. So I listened to a lot of punk, and that's in there, in the sort of, like, I don't know, anger of the characters when they come up against authority figures and things. But you wouldn't say it rattled along with a punk energy. Or maybe you would, I don't know.
Yeah, sure. Let's say it does. I think it does. I think it does. I think there's a certain scrappiness to this crew that is pretty punk.
Yeah, well, I would hope so, yeah.
What role do you think you would best fill on a spaceship?
Either the navigator or the cook.
Good with maps. Also an absolute delight in the kitchen. So that checks out, I think. Yeah,
I think they're both important roles, but they're sort of self-contained. Like, they're sort of vital to the... I sort of think that's a good role for me, to kind of be master of a domain, be that the galley or the chart room. I'll take it on.
As long as you can be master of something.
Well, quite.
Yeah. So finally, Malik the octopus is transported in a backpack when he's not in the engine tank. What animal would you like to keep in a backpack?
I don't know how you answer that, really. I think you'd want something not too heavy, for starters. Something that's not going to go mad when you put it in a backpack. So something quite calm. The octopus is quite useful because it has eight arms that can sort of come out and help you. So maybe that's something that would be useful. I think I'd just put a sloth in there, to be honest. And it would be very quiet, and we'd probably get on quite well.
I can see you walking around London with a sloth in your bag. Useful, long, claws if you've got an itchy back, I suppose. Just a nice vibe to have around, I guess.
I think so, yeah.
Calm. It would be calm. I don't really know. I don't know what I'd put in a backpack. Absolutely not an octopus, because it's my one lifelong phobia, has always been. Octopi. So I was quite put out when Owen showed me the first drawing for this book, and I realised one would feature quite heavily. It was not my favourite thing.
I didn't realise it was that much of an issue. I just thought you weren't fond of them.
No, they can all get in the bin. I understand that they're clever and charming in some ways, but they're also disgusting and creepy. And on that note, the note of disgusting and creepy, I'm going to say thank you to Owen for letting me sit in this room and aimlessly fire questions at him, and for creating The Hard Switch, which is out now in shops, comic book shops, wherever you buy your books. You can order it directly from Avery Hill, which I suggest you do, as at your nearest convenience, really. So thank you, Owen.
Thank you very much.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
We did it.